Thank you very much, Gerard, and it's a pleasure to be here, and good evening, everybody. As Gerard said, the topic of my talk tonight is mining booms and the Australian economy. I've chosen this topic because the Australian economy is currently experiencing a surge in mining activity. This is one of a sequence of mining booms since European settlement of Australia. These have been a very powerful force in shaping the Australian economy. So tonight I want to review the effects of these booms. In particular, I want to focus on the question of whether there are recurring themes that we can draw on in helping us to manage the current boom. My talk is based on research by a couple of my colleagues from the bank who are in fact here tonight. There's Ellis Connolly and Christine Lewis. They actually did the research for this, and they basically reviewed the work of a whole lot of economic historians. I won't take time now to list all these references, but for those of you who are interested, they're listed at the end of the version of my speech on the bank's website. The distinguishing features of a mining boom are significant increases in mining investment or mining output, or usually both, which go on to have very important macroeconomic consequences. On this basis, I think we can identify five major mining booms over the past 200 years or so. These are the 1850s gold rush, the late 19th century mining boom, the boom from the 1960s and early 1970s, which was a mineral and energy boom, the late 1970s, early 1980s boom, which was in that case an energy boom, and the current episode, which is again both a minerals and energy boom. There have also been quite a number of mini booms in mining activity, but given the time available tonight, I'm just going to focus on the five that I've just noted. So I'll start with a brief summary of the causes, characteristics and consequences of each of these booms, and then provide a more general assessment of the macroeconomic implications. So the 1850s gold rush was the first major mining boom in Australia. Economic historians note that the timing of these gold discoveries may have been related to to international developments such as the California gold rush of the 1840s, which had heightened general interest in gold exploration and mining. The first well-publicised find of gold in Australia, which was near Bathurst in New South Wales, was in fact by a veteran of the California gold rush. Domestic economic developments may also have influenced the timing of these gold discoveries, because of the continuing effects of the 1840s recession, there were plenty of workers available. In fact, labour was abundant and mobile, and therefore quite likely to become involved in exploration activity. This boom ended up being mainly centred on the goldfields of Victoria, as you know. It was atypical compared with later booms in that it was not accompanied by a large increase in mining investment. At that stage, large amounts of capital were not readily available, and in any case, the form of mining that was taking place, which was basically surface alluvial mining, was well suited to large inputs of labour and little inputs of capital. The boom lasted for about a decade and a half, and by the mid-1960s, the gold rushes of Victoria had largely faded. Measured in terms of value added to GDP, this boom greatly exceeded all subsequent mining booms. At its peak in 1852, mining comprised 35% of GDP. This created tremendous upheavals in the economy at the time. The value of exports from New South Wales and Victoria rose by a factor of 6 in 3 years, and exports of gold exceeded wool exports for the following 18 years. Labour flowed strongly to the gold states, particularly Victoria, and Melbourne became the largest city in Australia. Some of this flow of labour came from the other states. For example, the male populations of South Australia and Tasmania fell by 3% and 17% respectively in 1852. But a large amount of the labour also came from sharply increased immigration, and the Australian population almost trebled in the space of 10 years. Wages rose sharply, at first in mining, but then more generally across the country as labour flowed to the diggings. Between 1850 and 1853, wages in Victoria rose by 250%. Colonial governments had no powers over the money supply or the exchange rate. The money supply therefore trebled in the space of a couple of years, and all the adjustment in the economy took place via inflation. The rise in inflation meant that by the middle of the boom, the real exchange rate was about 50% higher than at the start. There was evidence of what we now call the Dutch disease, that is, damage to non-mining industries because of difficulty in retaining labour or facing increased costs and a higher exchange rate. For example, shepherds' wages doubled between 1850 and 1853, creating difficulty for the mining industry. Wool industry, and wool exports grew at much reduced rates. Also, according to one data source, the number of manufacturing establishments in New South Wales fell from 165 in 1850 to 140 a couple of years later. The overall impact on economic activity was, however, highly positive. Confidence was high. The flow of immigration greatly boosted the demand for goods and services. And industries servicing the mines, such as sawmilling, brick making and transport, all boomed. Parts of agriculture also did very well because of greatly increased demand for food. The infrastructure provided to service the mines, such as extensive road building, went on to have many positive effects in terms of opening up agricultural land. Growth in GDP remained very strong for a decade after the boom ended. Despite having a new source of tax and licence revenue generated by the gold find, governments faced pressures on their finances. This was because both of strong demand for infrastructure spending and the fact that the cost of providing that infrastructure was rising sharply due to higher wage costs. In 1853, for example, the Victorian government had to spend £520,000 on roads, compared with £11,000 2 years earlier. So governments therefore resorted to borrowing, which they did through the London markets. They found this relatively easy to do because the discovery of gold had made the colonies very creditworthy. The second boom was that in the late 19th century. This boom was driven by the discovery and development of new gold and metal mines across the country, but particularly in Western Australia, Queensland and Western New South Wales. Partly this was a natural consequence of the spread of the population to more remote parts of the country, but partly it also reflected capital market developments. There was ample capital available in London at the time to fund exploration activities, as the recession in the early 1890s had led to a fall in investment opportunities. Also, the development of the no-liability company made it much easier to access this capital. In 1894, there were 94 West Australian companies floated on the London market. 2 years later, there were 690. Sadly for the British investors, much of this money was never repaid in dividends, an indication of the risks that can come from mining investment. The main part of this boom took place against a very subdued economic background, both in Australia and in the major economies. The financial collapses that had occurred after the 1880s property bubble had burst had led to a global depression with very large falls in output and high unemployment. The continuing effects of the financial collapse meant that this boom, somewhat unusually, was not accompanied by a sharp acceleration in the money supply growth. Similarly, the large amount of spare capacity in the economy meant that there was a significant deflation at the start of the boom, which limited the subsequent peak in inflation. There was some pressure on wages as the unemployment rate fell sharply from the very high levels in the early 1890s, and there were signs of rising industrial disputation. The real exchange rate, however, did not move much through this episode. The current account, which had moved to a very large deficit in the 1880s property bubble to 13% of GDP, moved back to a more normal small deficit in the 1890s and eventually into surplus when the mining boom ended and the economy slowed in the early 1900s. The interregional effects of the boom, as in the 1850s, were very powerful. There were strong flows of labour into the new mine sites. The population of Western Australia increased from 48,000 to 180,000 during the 1890s, and the population of Broken Hill grew from 6,000 in 1888 to almost 20,000 in 1891. Places like Charters Towers also had its own stock exchange. There are also significant shifts in industrial composition. Exports of wool and grain stagnated, and metals took over as Australia's leading export. Eventually, the combination of rising costs, falling profits meant that capital dried up, investment fell, and the boom ended. Some of the policy actions taken at that time, such as the imposition of tariffs to protect urban industries, went on to have very long run effects on the economy. The third boom was that in the 1960s and early 1970s. This boom was quite broadly based, but the key parts were the sharp increases in the mining of coal and iron ore and the development of oil and bauxite discoveries. The background to this boom was that both the global and domestic economies were becoming increasingly stretched with rising commodity prices and rising inflation more generally. Particularly important for Australia during this period was the economic development of Japan. As well as adding to the global demand for resources, this had particular significance for Australia because Japan's proximity lowered transport costs and made the exploitation of certain minerals much more economically viable. This boom differed from the episodes of the 19th century in that it was much more capital intensive. Partly this reflected supply factors, as global capital markets had developed significantly since the turn of the century. Partly it also was due to technological factors, as some of the resources could only be developed with very large-scale investment. Mining investment rose from about 0.5% of GDP in 1960 to a peak of almost 3% in the early 1970s. Export prices rose strongly, particularly in the early 1970s, resulting in a large swing of income towards exporters. The current account of the balance of payments moved into surplus, an outcome that has not been repeated since. Employment grew strongly in the second half of the 60s by close to 3% a year, driven by large-scale immigration and a rising female participation rate. Wages rose strongly, and the centralised wage-fixing system spread those increases widely through the community. The nominal exchange rate remained fixed until towards the end of the boom, the eventual appreciation of the exchange rate in the early 1970s coming too late to benefit the economy. Money supply growth picked up to over 20% per annum in the early 1970s, and fiscal policy was also very expansionary. Not surprisingly, inflation rose sharply. Tariff cuts were introduced in 1973 to help control inflation, but the benefit of this was later offset by the imposition of import quotas to try to protect manufacturing jobs. By the mid-1970s, both the Australian economy and the global economy were experiencing severe difficulties, primarily flowing from the adverse consequences of very high inflation. The boom therefore ended, mining investment fell to low levels, and commodity prices stagnated. The fourth major boom was in the late 1970s, early 1980s. This boom was driven by the energy sector, in particular steaming coal, oil and gas. This followed the second of the oil price shocks in the late 1970s. In addition, the increased cost of energy made Australia an attractive place for energy-intensive activities such as aluminium smelting. Investment in mining started to pick up in the late 1970s and increased sharply in 1981 and 1982. This mining boom led to a sense of euphoria about Australia's future, which was accompanied by a resurgence in wage demands and rising inflation. Monetary and fiscal policies were tightened, but did not succeed in keeping the economy in check. The exchange rate system at that time involved the management of the Australian dollar against a trade-weighted index of currencies. The authorities followed a policy of appreciating the exchange rate, but with the benefit of hindsight, the rate of appreciation was relatively mild and did little to insulate the Australian economy from the rising inflationary pressures. The boom was relatively short-lived. The downturn in the global economy in 1981, following the oil price shock, meant that demand for energy ended up being much less than had been expected. This was reflected in both the volume and the prices of our exports. At the same time, the distortions caused by high wage growth and inflation and the resulting tight policies meant that by 1982-83, the domestic economy had followed the global economy into a severe recession. Now, this brings me to the current situation, which again, as I say, we see a surge in mining investment taking place right around Australia. It's again a very broad-based surge across a whole range of resources. But at the core is the large expansion in iron ore, coal and gas industries. It has been, to a large degree, driven by the demand for resources by emerging economies, with China, of course, being the most significant. Judged by the pattern of mining investment and commodity prices, the start of this boom can be dated from around 2005. By 2007 and early 2008, it was severely testing the productive capacity and the flexibility of the Australian economy. All that changed in the second half of 2008 as the effects of the mining boom were offset by the impact of the global financial crisis. However, now that that has passed, the underlying dynamics of the resource boom are starting to reappear. Many of the characteristics of this episode have been similar to those of earlier booms, but there are a few key differences worth noting. First, mining investment as a share of GDP has been significantly higher than recorded in the previous booms, and it's likely that it will rise substantially more. In terms of additions to output, the contribution of mining at this time has been larger than that in the booms of the 1960s and 1970s, but still below that in the late 19th century and much lower than that of the gold rushes in the 1850s. Second, the terms of trade have risen much more than they did in earlier mining booms. The current level of terms of trade rivals the sharp peaks that were associated with the increases in wool prices following the First World War and at the time of the Korean War. The current mining boom has therefore seen both the volume and the price of resource exports rise sharply. Third, this is the first mining boom during which the exchange rate has been floating. And it's one in which there's been a significant rise in the nominal exchange rate, and this has provided an important part of the economic adjustment. This has added an important degree of flexibility to the economy by allowing the real exchange rate to rise by means other than inflation. How long the current surge in mining activity will continue is uncertain. Past booms do not seem to have lasted more than about 15 years before resource depletion or international or domestic developments acted to slow economic activity and bring the boom to an end. On this occasion, the growth potential of countries such as China and India suggests that the expansion in resource demand could continue for an extended period. Whether this eventuates, however, will depend at least to some extent on the economic management skills of the authorities in these countries, not to mention our own. The booms that I've described took place over a period of about 160 years and against very different backgrounds, yet some similarities come through. The first point that stands out is the important role played by global events in causing mining booms in Australia. In some cases, this was due to the effects on prospecting activity. Examples here were the impact of the California gold rush on the 1850s boom and the availability of international capital to fund the 1890s boom. In some cases, the global effects came via a change in the relative price of commodities. The example here, of course, is in the late 1970s when the price of oil and energy rose sharply. And in other cases, the influence has been the emergence of powerful new trading partners, with examples being the development of Japan in the 1960s and China and India more recently. The second point I'd like to highlight is that the overall impact of each boom was to strengthen the economy. Increased investment in mining, higher income from mining activities, and the need for increased infrastructure to service the mines all worked in this direction. Also, each boom had high or at least increasing population growth in its early years, which added to the economic momentum. Not everybody benefited from the economic pickup, however. as some industries went into decline due to difficulty in competing for workers with the newly expanding sectors. The third point that seems clear from history is that every mining boom was accompanied by an increased inflationary pressure. Sometimes this was part of a global story, sometimes it was due to wage behaviour, but the general factor was the pressure on productive resources of the economy due to the expansion of economic activity. Leaving aside the current episode, only in the 1890s boom, which began, as I said, when the economy had very large-scale spare capacity, was the rise in inflation contained to single digits. One interesting issue is the role of the exchange rate in these booms. Economic theory suggests that part of the adjustment process for an economy experiencing a mining boom is a rise in the real exchange rate in order to facilitate the flow of real resources that is needed. In all the previous booms, however, the nominal exchange rate was either fixed or very tightly managed. The real exchange rate, therefore, could only adjust through inflation. In the current episode, with the floating exchange rate, the behaviour of the nominal exchange rate has been very different from the past. It has risen early in the boom and by a large amount. This has been an important factor helping to dissipate inflationary pressures. So let me conclude. History tells us that mining booms are periods of significant economic change and that they can pose complex challenges for policymakers. Among these is the need to ensure flexibility in the economy and maintain disciplined macroeconomic policies in order to contain the inflationary forces generated by the boom. History also shows that, in the past, these challenges proved to be very difficult to deal with. However, in the 30 years since the previous boom, the Australian economy has developed in ways which should make it better able to accommodate the surge in mining activity that is currently underway. The floating of the exchange rate is a key difference, but goods and labour markets are also more flexible and monetary and fiscal policy frameworks are now more soundly based. This gives grounds for confidence that we can do better this time, but the task will not be without its challenges. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Rick Battaglino. Right at the end of your talk, you mentioned flexible labour markets. I think earlier on you focused more on the most recent boom being coinciding with a floating exchange rate. But if you go back, as you will recall, to the booms 3 and 4, the one starting in the late 60s and the one starting in the late 70s, as you'd be aware, that had with a centralised wage system had a very big impact as wage changes moved through the system. How do you see us holding out specifically in the current boom on that?
Well, I think the ongoing effects of probably 20 years of labour market deregulation are still largely with us. So I don't think we're anywhere near the situation we're in with the centralised system of the 70s and the 80s. So I think in that regard we are in a better position.
Lynn, yes.
You mentioned just at the end of your speech the concentration of the power in the hands of some developing countries, China and India. But the other thing that's different about this boom is there's been quite a concentration of the industry itself. And the number of large mining companies really concentrated over the last decade or so. Can you see how that change in the landscape, in this, both on the buyer side and the supplier side, might impact how this current boom might play out?
I wouldn't kind of have a lot of expertise here, but it seems to me one of the effects of having a more concentrated resource sector is that there's much more discipline on investment going on in the sector. And my impression of looking back through booms in the past is that eventually what happens is that commodity prices rise because demand picks up. Eventually, investment responds, and within a few years, investment overtakes, that supply overtakes demand, and commodity prices start to fall again. This situation is a little bit unusual because my impression is even today, investment and supply have nowhere near caught up to demand for resources yet. The demand is still outstripping supply, and we see prices continuing to rise. So I think the fact that it's much harder for new entrants to come into the market, I think probably contributes to that outcome.
Rory.
Yeah. Deputy Government, you seem to be giving the exchange rate a green light to move higher, both to help the to help contain the weight and price pressure that will probably build as the mine boom progresses, and also to help the necessary adjustment of resources to help the economy adjust. Is that fair? Is there going to be ongoing upward pressure on the exchange rate? Is parity a dirty word?
The thing I've learned about exchange rate is they're very hard to predict because all sorts of economic factors come into play. And just when you think you've understood what's going on, something else comes along and you're proven to be quite wrong. But I think fundamentally, if the scenario works out the way people think with all this investment taking place, particularly in the gas industries, there's going to be a huge demand for investment in Australia and a huge demand on real resources, which can really only be accommodated by a higher exchange rate. So my guess is that in trend terms, the exchange rate will probably continue to rise. But, there's a lot of factors impinge on that, as we saw even last year through the crisis, where the Australian dollar went back from, in the 90-cent range to the 60-cent range very quickly. And these things can happen.
Okay, it's a question down the back and then we'll come up here, yes?
Intuitively, when we have a mining boom, we have a big surge in exports and the current account picks up, but we never seem to be able as a country to deliver on this sort of promise of the land of opportunity. It's never sustained. Why can't we break into an export-led type of economy like the manufacturing economy?
Well, the sequence with the mining boom now, at least, would be that in the first instance, the current account would probably deteriorate because we'd see a big increase in investment, a large amount of which would either be imported, and that would be funded by increased capital inflow, either direct investment or borrowings by resource companies. So we'd see both the current account deficit increase and the capital account surplus increase simultaneously. And at some point, as that investment starts to pay dividends and export sales pick up, we should see that trend reverse. But the situation now that we have a floating exchange rate is that really the current account is determined largely by foreign investors. So the current account and the whole Australian economy is responding and adjusting to what foreign investors want to do here. So that if there's a surge in foreign investment in Australia, we will end up with a current account deficit. There's no other way for the economy to equilibrate. And that's really been the history of Australia, and it's been much clearer in the period since we've had a floating exchange rate. The authorities have got no policy instrument to fix the current account deficit. The only thing you can really do to fix that would be to stop capital inflow through some form of controls on capital flows. If we did that, we'd very quickly find ourselves with a current account surplus. But, that's not an option that anybody wants. So I think for the time being, the current account will probably, if anything, even get larger. I don't think that's a worrying sign. I think people, we've learned from the last 20 years or so that the current account deficit really adjusts to the economy. It's part of the adjustment process of the economy.
Maurice Newman.
There is an alternative, of course, that is the degree to which the central bank and the government controls domestic consumption. And I'm intrigued to sort of drill down into the whole issue of the sterilisation of all this capital inflow coming from mining investment and the additional stimulus of $42 billion, or the remnants of that government stimulus, relatively full employment around 5.5, whatever it is, and a more rigid employment regime, all of which could, at least in the short run, lead to certain outbreaks in price inflation. I'm just interested in your comments.
Well, at the moment, inflation is still coming down. So we had that period from, really starting from 2005, when inflation started to pick up, and by 2007, 2008, inflationary pressures here were getting, and they were nowhere near the standard that we got to in previous mining booms. You know, when at that stage we were already into double digits, so here, so inflation peaked at 5%. But really, that was, it was a tough situation even then, and the bank was raising interest rates to keep that in check. Mining booms are very powerful. You know, they have a very powerful effect on the economy. Through that period, a lot of people were complaining. They were saying that consumer spending was quite weak. It was quite weak. House building was not strong. But the truth is that given the scale of the other activities that were taking place in Australia and the fact that it all had to fit in within an overall sort of capacity constraint, there wasn't a lot of room for consumer spending or for house building. That's the reality of the situation. There's only so much activity that can take place. And if we want to have all this mining investment and mining output, which is happening, the basically other parts of the economy for the moment have to be restrained somehow, because the economy can't do all these things simultaneously.
Which you do through interest rate policy.
Which we do through interest rate policy.
One instrument you haven't discussed, Deputy Governor, is what Norway, Chile, Alaska, other resource-rich places have done, and the Governor touched on late last year, is setting up a stabilisation fund or an offshore sovereign fund. If this boom is going to run on, isn't this a really good idea that people like yourself and the Treasury should be really pushing and really getting the policymakers to think about as a way of channeling some of this money offshore and taking some of the heat out of the economy and out of the exchange rate?
That's one option. The difference between Australia and Norway is that my understanding is that Norway's supply of oil was relatively limited, and so it made sense that all the benefits of that oil extraction weren't sort of consumed by one generation. The situation we face here in Australia is that there's sort of there's enough resources in the ground to satisfy many generations. And so the question is, it's an intergenerational issue. The second issue is that setting up government funds, investment funds, is not always easy. You know, it's very difficult to manage money in the government sector. And, the sensitivities are all very, very different from the way the private sector manages money. So it's not clear to me that's a, it is all pluses to go down that route.
There's a question here. As a geologist, I have a comment rather than a question. At present, the high price of gold has induced for geologists to go out and explore the old mining districts. Some of the mines have been closed, you know, decades ago, even 50, 100 years ago. Now, what will, and a few mines have been reopened lately. What will happen in the future when the gold price will come down? Do you think these mines will then become uneconomic again?
Well, I assume so. The answer is yes, I think, yeah. But is the gold price coming down? That's another question.
Deputy Governor, I wonder if you could comment on the recently flagged possibility of a 40% tax on mining companies in Canberra.
I really couldn't offer any comment there. I'm no expert on tax. Look, you couldn't get a better person than Ken Henry to look at that issue, and I'm very happy to go along with anything he decides.
You get the toughest questions from the novelist, not from the economist. It's a question down there. Yeah.
Just coming back to wage inflation and the possibility of breakout. Anecdotally, I would have thought there's much more danger at the moment. From the enormous amount of resources that's going into schools and things in the direct labour content going into the mining. But my question is, how does fiscal policy fit into this mix, or do we just rely on interest rates, a frankly very blunt instrument, to bring this under control?
Well, the fiscal policy that was put in place was done with this in mind, so, you know, it is automatically scaling back even as we speak. So that's that was all allowed for. The thing though with fiscal policies, there's not the flexibility that there is with monetary policy to keep making changes and fine tuning. And so once you've set a course, it takes it longer to change direction again. So fiscal policy is withdrawing stimulus from the economy now. The peak in stimulus was back at the end of 2008, when we had all that money paid out to the households. That was really the peak, and it's probably been contracting somewhat since then.
Shall we get a partner again?
Now, Gillis, I should remind me that the topic really is mining booms in the Australian economy, so we're here. Gillis.
I would like to understand, mining booms in the past have been around relatively small volumes of material. The mining boom this time is massive volumes of material. How can we, or what effect might our lack of infrastructure bring to this mining boom? And how can we stimulate government and private enterprise to get stuck into creating greater infrastructure, particularly, I would say, on the East Coast?
Well, I think these problems are not new. I mean, the infrastructure demands from the sort of the 1850s gold rush and those, they were just as severe as anything we're facing today. They're on a different scale, but, just as severe. And, in fact, the impact, those early booms from the 19th century, they had a much more buoyant effect on the economy than what's going on at the moment. Their contribution to GDP growth was much more. So I think these problems are not new. In terms of what to do at the moment, well, I think, it's obviously some planning involved, but a lot of it comes from some private sector people responding to market signals. And I think as the effects of the global financial crisis pass and credit becomes available and money capital markets become more readily functioning, we'll see. There will be scope for those things to re-emerge. But mining booms do create huge demands on other parts of the economy, and they have to be met. And it's not always easy to meet that.
The concept that you hear some, I heard an academic talking about this on a program recently, and goes back a long way as Australia is some kind of quarry to the world. I mean, that's rhetoric. But as an economist, would you handle that kind of argument? I mean, is there something wrong with with having an economy that has so many mining booms over so short a time, or is it just what we do?
Well, that's what we do. It's a natural advantage we have, but we shouldn't overestimate. Most people in Australia are employed in the services industry, in servicing the mines, working in coffee shops and restaurants and other stores. So it really is a service-based economy. But we actually generate a lot of wealth from the few people who are employed in mining. The thing you notice is that whereas in the 19th century, these booms were used up a lot of labour resources, in these days, it's mainly capital investment that's taking place and very little impact on labour. But that income, the income from that from the boom, does spread widely through the community, and I think the effects flow more broadly. The general pattern is that a lot of people talk about two speeds economies, but through mining booms, it's usually the case that all parts of the Australian economy benefit. Some benefit more than others, so you have very fast and fast. They're the two speeds. And the situation in 2007 was a little bit unusual in that respect, because New South Wales in particular was relatively soft. But if you look back through a broader sweep of history, most of the time when there's a mining boom, sure, Queensland and Western Australia are doing brilliantly, but other states are also doing very well.
Okay, there's a question there. Yeah.
Deputy Governor, we've got mining investment as a share of GDP at around 4, I think, in your paper, and there's been estimates that it
could rise by another couple of percentage points to GDP with these LNG projects.
Yes.
But you can just give us your feel about how big you think, given it's been interrupted by the crisis now picking up again, this whole new phase of LNG, how big do you think, you can sort of feel your, almost your qualitative feel for how big it will get? And just a second one, if I could, a point of history. Are you saying, I think I read it right, that the late 1800s boom fed into the political economy of protectionism in Australia and the Australian settlement through some Dutch disease?
Well, on that second question first, I think, well, I'm not an economic historian, but my understanding is from what others have written at that time that, yes, there was. So, you know, governments do feel under pressure to help sectors that are suffering or not doing as well through that period. And that has happened at various times. We've done a lot of work through our Western Australian representative office looking at this question of the gas fields in Western Australia, and I have to say it's a very big story, and it's hard to put a finger on exactly how much investment is going to take place, but I don't think it's unreasonable to expect mining investment to rise, as you say, to 6% of GDP over the next few years, and that would be about twice as high as it got to in the previous boom. So it's a very big boom.
Now we're not going to go on further, but we're getting to the end of the question there, yeah?
Governor, assuming that the North Atlantic countries make a reasonable recovery over the next few years, given that the oil price today is around about $80 a barrel, when oil consumption has been even or even slowing over a couple of years, what's the effect of a rising oil price or energy prices on this boom because transport is a big factor for some of these commodities?
Hmm. Well, it's a big issue. As you say, I think the thing that's striking about what's happened over the past 2 years is that despite the global economy having the so-called worst recession since the Depression, and in fact, in the developed economies, that was the case. The level, the trough in commodity prices, was extraordinarily high. And if that is a trough in commodity prices in the peak of a very severe recession, it's a sign that demand-supply balances in those markets are very tight, and that as those economies continue to pick up, we will see continued upward pressure on those prices.
This question down the back.
You talked about the ballooning current account deficit, and I understand Australia has the highest debt per capita almost in the world. Is there some responsibility in policy to try and increase the saving rate in Australia so that we're somewhat less dependent on foreign capital? Increase the saving rate via increasing consumption taxes or higher superannuation contributions. Do you think there's an ongoing requirement to do that?
Well, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about Australia's current account and saving rate. So most countries around the world, when they've got a current account deficit, it's usually because savings are very low. That's not the case for Australia. Australia runs a current account deficit because investment is very high. So if you looked at our Australia's savings rate, it's actually at least as much as other developed economies. The thing that stands out about Australia is we've got much higher investment rates than other developed economies. People look at the household savings rate, and the national accounts measures of that look quite low. But that measure of saving in the national accounts is a largely meaningless measure. And it doesn't take into account the institutional arrangements in Australia, because in Australia, the household sector actually owns the corporate sector. Because we've all got our money invested in equities through our super funds and directly, the household sector directly owns the corporate sector. And so in measuring savings, you have to look at the combination of the corporate sector and the household sector combined. And if you look at that, there's nothing wrong there at all. It's actually very, very good. So I don't think we have a savings issue that we have to deal with. If we did, I'm not sure what the answer is, because at the end of the day, overall savings rates are in fact determined by a whole lot of adjustments taking place in the economy, and they are in turn responding to what foreigners are doing with capital flows here. So the exchange rate is a big part of that. But as I say, I don't think there's an issue there to deal with in the first place.
Yes, there's a question here, the second last question here.
What's the sovereign debt? What's the impact of the current boom on our sovereign debt?
Well, if you're talking about foreign currency debt, there's none because the government has no foreign currency borrowing. Domestic debt, well, I assume that this, if there is a pickup in economic activity, well, the budget situation will improve and the sovereign debt on issue will go down. I mean, Australia is at the very bottom of the range in terms of having debt on issue. So, you know, every other country in the world would love to be in our position. It's a very strong position and, you know, it'll probably only get better again.
Just a final question, just glancing back on your paper, you seem to be suggesting this seems to be the longest of the of all the booms through the 19th and the 20th century, and you don't seem to be looking at any kind of end to this boom, which goes back, and there was some comments before the global financial crisis that the boom could last for 10 or 20 years. You think that's what, that's possible?
I think it's possible. If you look at the development that lies ahead for places like China and India, I mean, they could easily keep very high growth rates for another 20 years. But the question is managing those growth rates and keeping the economy on track. And, you know, I think it would be wrong to assume that there will be sort of an uninterrupted line of growth. I mean, there will be economic cycles through that period. But if you look at a broad sweep of history, I think it is highly likely that, you know, the next 20 years or so, the average commodity prices and demand for resources will be higher than it was in the previous 20 years. But there will be cycles around that. But, you know, we've all learned to live with cycles, and that's just part of life. There's nothing you can do about those.
Deputy Governor, many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you very much.